started. So the point of part of what we do today is to give you some feedback on the some very preliminary feedback, essentially solely based on what we saw in the presentation yesterday, and we certainly haven't seen any more. I'm sure you elaborated more on some of these things, but I'd like to pose some questions based on what I saw and based on what the other guest lecturers saw, and I conversed with them after that, and they raised a few questions, and I'd like to share those with you so that you can strengthen your ideas now and in the future. Overall, I think you both teams had done a good job in covering the five important aspects. It was clear in your discussion where each of the aspects begins, where it ends, and what we should expect from a particular slide. Now, speaking of slides and having guests, you certainly didn't know who's coming and how many people are coming. But I do recommend that in the future you sort of bring printouts of your slides, because there's people sitting in the back and people who can't see your font, or for some reason can't quite relate to the way you speak, but maybe they want to look at things and maybe they want to take notes. If they have nothing to take notes on, then you know you're losing that kind of feedback, because they may want to wait until the end and then they forget the question. Right. Speaking of notes, I anticipated that and I printed the notes for you, so that each of the guests actually had a printout of the notes. Your backgrounds for both teams were dark. When you do printouts, you should have your background on white for two reasons. First, it's much easier to write on white so that it's visible, and second of all, you don't waste color. So I actually changed the design, printed the thing, had it in the hands of the people in your audience. I think that's going to be a good thing to keep in mind for your future presentation. And it will probably always be the case that you will not be quite sure who's coming and when they're showing up, and there's going to be some vice president or something showing up in the last moment and nobody expects it, but that's to be expected. So I would just make the very high-level comment that actually makes sense to think about when you write your documents before you submit them tonight. Of course, these are not final versions. You can always update them after the fact. And the more detailed ones, which is mine and the accumulation of what I have from the guests, I will send to the individual teams. But some of those will relate to issues that are not necessarily pertinent to what you submit tonight, but maybe some more general. All right, so it looks like both teams were able to get across the main idea of what they were trying to do, both with the succinct description. This is a collaborative art game, or this is a real-time document editing. I can't even remember the five or six words, but it certainly makes a lot of sense to people when you do that. So that certainly was clear. I was pleased to see that both teams had actually used some of the descriptions that we talked about in the architecture. These are going to be useful for you. Treat them as not, again, I'm repeating myself here, but this was something that the guests told us as well. Treat them as a living document. This is not a final thing. That is a great piece of work. The only problem with it is that it does not live in a slide, and it does not live in the notes of the people who actually take them. So if for the future you make this in the last moment, or for some reason it can't go on a slide, maybe you can't scan it, or the resolution is too small, or some such thing, you did have it on paper, so just, you know, make a copy of that paper and distribute it. This way people can actually annotate and they can tell you, well, why does this connect to that? Should it connect to the other thing? If it's on a board, then it's more difficult for you to get feedback. But it's great. I actually took a snapshot of it with my digital camera yesterday, so I'll send that. Okay? So I'll go over some of the other comments. Some of them will be specific to one team, and some of them will be specific maybe to the other team. And if there's general issues, that I'll try to address those. As far as first TeamForge, so because Gail was the instructor in Spring Quarter, and in Spring they had done RailPack, which is very similar to yours, a lot of her comments here related to how yours differs from RailPad and what you might be able to carry over from RailPad. Of course, certainly one of her suggestions was go find one of these people and ask them about the difficulties they had. I talked to her afterwards, and she said that, you know, it was just mildly difficult to set up the environment, but then after that, it was not a problem at all. All the APIs were there. You know, people did not have any difficulty making that work. That may actually relate to something I overheard here just before lecture that you were considering maybe swapping that for something else. That's certainly your decision, but it's a risk. Keep it in mind. So perhaps distinguishing yourself from known pieces is what she was aiming at, what she was trying to get at. I mean, clearly, in your case, you've got a real-time, and theirs was also sort of a real-time, except that the unit of atomicity is slightly different, which is where one of her questions came. Is it on a paragraph level? Is it on a sentence level? Is it only when I save the document and the other person can see it? That's where the difference really lies, and that's what you probably want to be emphasizing when talking to, you know, people who have that kind of background. Which brings me to an issue that both teams ought to consider, and that is what, and I'd like to see some approximation at least, even if that changes. What types of tools do you think you will need to do the job? So one of the teams said Java only, and the standard libraries are just fine for us. Okay, that's a good answer. I didn't quite get as good of an image in my mind as far as TeamForge. So you said Ruby on Rails and some Google Web Toolkit. I wasn't sure what the Google Web Toolkit is going to do and why it is useful and why that but not something else. Maybe that's already written in your document. But if it's not, try to somehow elaborate on this and just explain why you're choosing this. Maybe it has some significant benefits over the alternative. Same thing here, Java only has some significant benefits over the alternative because it's, you know, just one piece, it's uniformly available, everybody can run it, no need to install anything else beyond, well, you know, the latest version, whatever you're using there. I think that's a good thing. So just make sure to address those things. I think that would belong in a system requirement along with the rest of those. So when you describe the features that you have or what you're expecting from the system, when you say you're going to have a database, any sort of characteristics from that database? Does it need to be, you know, one type or another type? Does it need to have some special language with it? I mean, certainly MySQL is probably good enough for you, but is that what you're looking for, or is it something else? Part of it is also for me to know what sort of tools you're expecting so that if there's anything that I haven't already pre-requested from support, then I can actually ask them to try to install. I actually went ahead and talked to one of the support guys, and he has set up Ruby on Rails already. There's still some testing he needs to do with that, but it's already available on one of the machines on Qubit, I believe. So if that's something you want to pursue, I will send you the details that he gave me. And there's not too much details, but at least you'll know where it is and how to find it. Another joint comment related to both teams was when you talk about testing. So a lot of it looked like you were discussing testing at the developer level, at the unit testing level, and this is great because unit testing is certainly one of the techniques that has become a de facto standard for developing solid applications. But there's other types of testing as well, and one fundamental one is what's called end-to-end testing or acceptance testing. We haven't discussed this a lot, but the point of it is that a unit test only tests a unit. It only tests this method or this module or something small. Eventually, when your users need to run your application, they're not as much concerned about whether this particular unit runs correctly. This is something that you as developers will probably know, and it will give some confidence to your audience knowing that you've had 70% coverage with unit tests, for instance. But what the ultimate thing that users care about is, when I start this application, does it call this module and then communicate with the database, get the right data, process it, output it to the screen, for example. That's one of, for instance, your use cases. So if the user starts an action, does it end with the expected thing on the other side? So you can think of this more as a black box thing. If I put this input, do I get the expected output on the other side? And it sort of feels like a unit test, except that now you're treating the whole system that you're building as a unit, as opposed to, you know, one module or one method. And so it's more difficult in some ways, but it's also more easy. It's more easy because anybody can do that. Presumably, any of your users can say, if I enter this as an input, that's what I expect as an output to happen out of my system. Whereas for unit tests, it's more technical and it's more specialized, so it takes more time. Yeah?
Is that the same as like functional tests, or how do they differ?
I'd say functional tests are probably part of it, because when you say functional test, I'm thinking that you're testing only the function. Whereas an acceptance test may also test other things, like scalability is also part of an acceptance test.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that the thing scales. Some sort of robustness or safety or security test, these are not functions really. These are just wide things across the whole system. And they also usually get into that. But the easiest thing certainly to test is an end-to-end test. And the first thing to absolutely be thinking about is a functional test. Sometimes you hear it as a system test, because it's testing the whole system, or an end-to-end, you know, from the beginning to the end, that's the end-to-end, or acceptance, meaning that should I accept this thing as working completely? Or maybe are only 5 of the 6 components working and the 6th one is somehow producing the wrong result or failing? So that's the system test. So give some thought to that. We haven't discussed it yet. I know that it's probably a new notion, but give some thought to that and do include it in your testing methodology. These two things are really central. So it's the unit test on a lower level and it's the system test, functional test, or end-to-end test at a higher level. Speaking of which, there was some discussion of this in open space when you said, you know, you play your music or you... what else did you say there? Verifying that the correct music plays, something like this. I can't find the exact phrase here. And that felt like something you'd hardly be able to test without actually somebody sitting there and saying, okay, I'm starting this song. Is it the right one or is it the wrong one? It's a little bit difficult for a computer to determine that. And you may be able to substitute it with some surrogate test. But that certainly is an end-to-end test because presumably one of your use cases is, I need that song to be playing, and you make sure that it is playing. It's just harder to automate. For the unit test and for the functional test, it's all the better if you can automate as many of them as you can. That said, there is some difficulty with automating anything related to GUI testing. And I think you spoke a little bit about it. Hoping to incorporate a tool to script the user action.
Yeah.
I think
that's the other group.
That'd be great. Can you send a mail to the mailing list?
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's easier to use with Quest.
With any restrictions that there are, yeah. Just say what there is to say,
okay.
And then people will decide whether they want. Okay. So it's great to hear that actually there's some possibility for one group using the results of the other and maybe the ideas of the other. As I've mentioned before, this certainly you are not under no competition with each other, and I encourage. To the highest extent possible in collaboration. I do expect that some more collaboration may happen in the future, in fact, because both of your teams have some real-time component to them. One is drawing real-time, the other one is typing text and having that appear on the other end real-time, and both are network applications. So there will be some challenges related to the real-timeness or getting there on time or some such thing that one of the teams will probably figure out 2 days ahead of the other. If there's one of these things, by all means, I encourage you to share that, because this way all of us get to learn. For both teams, again, getting feedback as early as you can will help you. Sometimes it will be a really crude thing. And that's something that you can get feedback on the architecture. But if you're wondering whether you need to actually build a game before you can actually show it to the user, you can create mock-up screens like you did actually on your presentation and say, imagine that you're on this screen, what would you do now? And the user will say, well, I'm going to draw a line here. All right, so if you draw a line, here's what will show up. This is the next mock-up screen. And okay, and now I'm going to join a game. For instance, press this button. Okay, when you join a game, here's what happens. That kind of testing can also help you initially. Certainly not as much, and not with the fine details that may be having a real pen and a real brush and a real set of several people changing your brushes underneath you will do, but it will help some. So. And it's a cheap one, so you can think about pulling that a little forward. Again, for both teams, is there someone, I'm just reading it as the guest phrased it, is there someone who has as their responsibility an overall project lead? And this question was asked to one of the teams, and you try to answer. The follow-up question is, what are the checks and balances? So typically, the role of a project lead, and I'm not advocating here, I'm just explaining what the question means. It's your decision how you do that. So typically, the role of the project lead is to actually be responsible for delivering the thing, be the contact person, be the one who keeps the schedule, and make sure that if we've got a release tonight, that all the pieces that are expected from the different contributors in the team are actually in place. It's maybe the one who integrates them into one and the one who submits them. And just somebody's got to do that. Five people can't submit. Five people can't all integrate in the thing. Or else they can, but it's a waste of effort. So somebody's got to do that. So the person who's responsible for making sure that happens, you can call that the project manager. They don't have to be above you in any way. They don't have to be telling you what to do. Just somebody has to fill that role. Okay. So that's I think that's what they were aiming for. And as far as checks and balances, what that means is if something goes wrong, who discovers it? Or if a ball is dropped, if a component needs to be developed by day X but it isn't, who decides what to do with that? I mean, maybe the team together. somebody's got to notice that and ring a bell and say, hey, we're behind on this. What should we do? Maybe we should reallocate somehow the resources. And the final comment I have here, assuming I haven't missed anything, I don't think I have, is as far as your timeline and your schedule. Now, one of the teams had core functionality, I think it was TeamForge, and I asked you, where was your integration step? And you said, well, integration is really the core functionality. So make sure you put that there and say, this is the integration step. The core functionality may be its functionality. Integration is not functionality. My point here is that ought to happen first. And Jim Bullock, who was here yesterday, is going to come here tomorrow and talk about that. And, of course, answer any of your other development and management and just deployment types of questions that you might have. The equivalent thing for the other team, as I remember it, was week one, we're going to develop some set of features, and then second thing, integrate. And it's exactly backwards. You integrate first, and then you develop the features. First thing that needs to happen is there's a one line here, on the client, for instance, and there's a one line in the server. You make sure that the client can communicate to the server. And actually, the demo that I believe David had developed does some of that. So you may already have done much of this work. If there's other components that need to be there, databases, whatever needs to be there, that's what the integration step needs to make sure happens, including some of the other things that we'll talk about tomorrow. But this is certainly one important one. So integration first, then everything else. That was my point, and I think it was the last one here on my list. I like how different people took part in the presentation. It's not the same person who was talking all the time. Very often you would actually see the latter. You would see one person who is actually pretty experienced with that and just shows up and says, here's my team and here's what we've done. That probably is more appropriate for an industry setting because the stakes are higher over there. You want to make sure that really the person who talks best can present your product. But here we've got some different goals as well, which is to give everybody the chance to practice, because you get good with practice. You don't get good with just, being born as a good speaker. Yeah?
Can I make a comment about that?
Absolutely.
If everybody's going to be up there, I think it's really important that everybody be conscious that they're still a part of the presentation, even if they're not speaking right at the moment. So they got to look like they're actually interested in, what the speaker's saying. And a lot of times, it just, doesn't look as professional. People are standing up there and kind of, looking around, which I assume that everybody's really knows a lot about it and does might be not feel like you have to pay attention, but you have to look like you are, otherwise it looks like I'm really kind of unprofessional. So that would be my one comment.
And it may I agree with that, and it may create the false impression that you don't want to be doing this, that you're not interested in this thing, and if your audience thinks that, and if they're your customers, they may wonder, well, am I going to succeed with this team if half of them seem uninterested? And in fact, they may be totally interested, just their mind wandering off someplace else. Okay, so do you have, since I ran out of the main comments and I'll send you the full list, do you have questions that we need to answer, that Lincoln and I need to answer? So other things related to your documents, to the feedback that I just gave, tried to present here, which will help you do a better job tonight.
have a question about the task list.
Task list, okay.
I was wondering, how detailed should it be? Because, I mean, I understand that will probably be one of the things that changes quite a bit, because we'll find out we need new tasks, or tasks that we put there, we won't need to do. So, I'm just kind of wondering how to gauge, like...
Well, the answer will be different depending on whether that's in the write-up or whether that's in a presentation. In a presentation, you don't want to belabor things too much. You just want to give a flavor so that people understand and can ask an intelligent question, and so that you can show that you've done the work. In a write-up, you know, there's more space. You have no constraint on a slide. You have no constraint on a 2 minutes or such thing. I'd say, to the extent that you are informed and have thought about the set of tasks, just put them there. You don't have to spare that. You know, some structure will certainly help rather than just a list of tasks without any order. So some sort of structure, maybe on time, this is going to happen week one, week two, week three, or maybe this is the server component task, this is the client component task. Some such structure will help people to, you know, maybe decide whether they want to look any deeper in your task, or maybe they don't want to look any deeper in your task, and they can, and if maybe a reader is interested mostly in the client task, then they'll, you know, narrow down and quickly focus on this. So if you've thought of, you know, a set of tasks, by all means put them there, and there ought to be some, but you don't have to go too far into this, because you're right, this is the part that probably changes most frequently. At least once a week, more likely even more than that, in a real project. Because, you know, the environment changes, things change, people get reassigned to do other things, there's needs to complete certain things before you anticipate it, and needs to postpone certain things after you anticipated doing them. This was actually one of the comments that was made, I didn't have it written down here. So the two people said, students are usually used to a very bounded set of tasks. So, in your classes so far, you've probably been given homework, but the homework is very bounded in the sense that it's clear that it has a solution, and it's clear that it can be done in a week, and it's clear that, you know, one person is enough or two people are enough. None of these things are true here. It's not clear that you have a solution, or, you know, maybe for some problems. It's not clear that you can do it in a week, and it's not clear, and it certainly hasn't been done before. I haven't done it, and, you know, Lincoln hasn't done it, and we may have done similar things, but not this exact thing. Unlike other classes where, you know, the thing has been tried 50 times before, and the instructor knows exactly how many hours it will take you, and these things aren't there. So part of your job is to actually, you know, take this unclear big blob and scale it down to the point where it becomes clear and that you know how to handle the individual components, and then those get put together to make one big whole. Of course, we get help with that, but that's really that's reality. That's how things are in the real world, and we're trying to give some flavor of this. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Other comments? Lincoln, did you have anything else to add?
No, I think you got one from Wes.
Okay. All right. Then. The design discussion that I started, I believe, on Friday of last week. So we were talking about core principles and best practices, and This is a 5, it should be something there. Trade design is a wicked sloppy heuristic process. Don't settle for the first design, collaborate, try for simplicity. Prototype, iterate, and you'll be happy. So we've done the first bullet on the outline list. We talked about best practices. I'll quickly remind you what those were, and then we'll move on to the principle. Now, what's called a principle and what's called a practice, there may be some overlap between the two, but these are actually known as principles with their names. And I'll tell you what their names are, along with what they mean. Resources are same as before. The ones that are actually easily accessible to you are the online chapter of Code Complete, which covers a lot of these things and gives somewhat different examples, so that's useful. The reading from the Pragmatic Programmer, a couple of sections, portions of Chapter 2 and Chapter 5, and the handout that I gave last time, or on Friday, about design style. How you can tell a good design from a bad design, and what some characteristics may be that will tell you that something's wrong with a particular design. We'll say a few words about this. So here are the practices that we elaborated on last time, and I'll just very quickly want to show them here to refresh memories and to make sure everybody's on the same page. So creating several different designs so that you have a choice, so that you can merge and create hybrids of them. Keeping it simple, including the set of functionality, but also in how you develop things, and also in using the environments that make the most sense, like, you know, perhaps Java only. It sounds to me like keeping it simple as opposed to integrating several things, although in some cases you may want to for extended functionality. Asking yourself how you will test, especially the end-to-end test, but also the unit test, up front, because testability is highly correlated with design, with good design. If you can't test it, then there's some sort of contraction in your system. There's something that doesn't need to be coupled as tightly as it is coupled. Not spending too much time in the visualization. Quickly by hand, I think you got that, and you did this in the LCAs. Learning to use design patterns. I hope that we'll get a chance to talk about them later this quarter. Some of them are rather interesting and useful, and not as hard as they may sound. Looking for single points of failure. I think I asked one of the teams yesterday, it was probably Team Forge, which of the components, so there was a class diagram, and asked which of the components was the essential one. Is there one that all the communication goes through? Because if there is one like this, then that's your single point of failure. That's the thing that holds all the critical information. That's the thing that, if it's not correct, if it goes down or if something else happens, go down being as a separate service, then your whole application doesn't quite work. So if there's one such thing, then there are some added constraints you need to be considering, like, should I be focusing on all the information here, or maybe should that be distributed elsewhere? So that depends on the constraints of your application. But having that in mind and knowing this while you're doing the design is certainly better than not knowing this and by accident just making things in a way that makes them fragile. Using abstractions as much as possible. This was the example with the square and the 4 points, where I said that, you know, a square is defined by, sorry, not the 4 points, but the 4 coordinates, that a square is defined by points, not by coordinates. The points are defined by coordinates, but that's one level removed. So you want to be using the abstraction of a point when you're defining square and other things. So today we'll actually have other examples that kind of relate to this principle as well. Encapsulate changing components. If there's an algorithm that will need to change, or maybe two versions of an algorithm, then you probably want those to be in one module, so that but the interface to whatever uses that algorithm being fixed, so that even if you decide to change the algorithm later on, you can swap that, the interface still remains the same, it's still used the same way, nobody needs to know that the algorithm changed. That's one of the principles of the article by David Parnas that I was citing earlier on in the reference. And finally, the favor composition over inheritance. Can somebody remind me what that was? Right, so if at all possible, include a reference to the class or the behavior that you need, as opposed to trying to inherit from the existing class. And I was giving the example with animals, and animals that can fly, and animals that can walk, and animals that can jump, and it will create a too rich hierarchy, and it will make it brittle, because now what you do with animals that can both fly and walk and all the other things. Okay. So with that, here now we go with the principles. First one is, I'm sure familiar to most of you, it's referred to as loose coupling or weak coupling. That's what is getting violated when you can't test things easily, because then you need to instantiate five different things in order to test one. And that tells you that those five are actually coupled more than they should be, because of an unnecessary dependency. Now, there's something called the law of Demeter. I'm not sure even how to pronounce that, because I've never heard it pronounced. And what it says is, I've copied it here, it says, any method of an object should call only methods belonging to itself, meaning using class, to any parameters that were passed into the method, because now you have a handle, to any objects that it created, because it has the ability to access those objects immediately, or to any directly held component object inside that same class. And the example, the three-line example here, actually violates. Can you see one? This was taken from the Pragmatic Programmer in one of the two chapters. So I definitely recommend looking there. Which of these parts is violated? And why? And why is that a problem? Looks like something you're doing all the time. These are fine distinctions, I should mention. I mean, all of the principles that we'll have today are fine distinctions, but they have large repercussions if you violate them. And they won't look like a misplaced column or the wrong character or something like this. They are not obvious at all. They are very hard to catch, even with tools. Get balance is a method of apparently bank account. Correct. Up to here, nothing's being violated. The violation happens on the last line. Yeah, apparently this is a static method, or method of the same class, of the class that show balance belongs to.
So then you're calling a method from something else, like from the amount, which is
Yeah, that's the problem. It's okay to be calling a method of something that you have a handle on, or belong to class. I think it's the any parameters that was passed in. This is fine. The problem is that here, in the last line, you're calling a method of an object that you just got on the previous thing by calling a method of an object that you have. So it's the same thing as with the square. This is two levels removed from you. This is not your immediate thing that you can touch. It's essentially you're trying to poke into something that should be hidden from you. And why is this a problem? Can you think of why this is a problem? That's certainly the symptom of it, but why is this a problem? What is tightly coupled? Let's go back to this. So you're saying show balance and print format are coupled. And you can generalize this by saying the class that contains show balance, I don't know what it is, but in that fragment, is now coupled to the money class. In the sense that the money class now no longer has the ability to decide that I'm not going to have a print format, or maybe the print format is somehow going to change. You are now relying on not only get balance to be there, and that's fine because you have a contract. If I pass you a reference to a bank account, then you should expect to be able to use all the things of a bank account. But what about all the things that a bank account can use itself? And what if there is no print format, but maybe you were able to obtain a handle to some other object and then trying to poke inside that? So this will try to couple you to all of these other things. What if some of them actually need to change? What will need to happen? If print format suddenly needs to disappear and be replaced with another method, not only will that need to happen in the money class, but it will also need to be reflected in the class that includes your show balance, which has nothing to do with the money class. So a change in one place will propagate in several different places. And how are you going to know it? It will be really neat if you had this module design where you know this is a change and nothing really should affect anything else. Now it does affect everything else. And you better have a way to discover what other 100 places it affects so that you fix it. So that's the problem here. Kind of a fine one, but it's the problem. Do ask questions now and in the future. The rest will look just as fine as this one.
So how do we fix it?
What do you think?
I'm thinking that it counts somehow returning something that you should be able to print. Or
let me give another. Yes. Let me give another parallel. The parallel is, imagine that you're building a house, and of course you don't know how to build a house with all the details, so you hire a contractor. And the contractor doesn't know how to do all the details, so they hire subcontractors. This is sort of the same here. The show balance is like you wanting to build a house. The get balance is hiring the contractor. And now the print format is hiring the subcontractor, because it's the contractor that does it. It's the amount that gets the call to the other method. And the problem, of course, in our scenario with the house and contractors and subcontractors, is that in this kind of method, it looks like the person who wants to build a house directly calls the subcontractor and tells him, why don't you bring two bags of nails? Because we're going to need those for the house. That's not your job. It's the job of the contractor to decide how many bags of nails are necessary and how many 2x4 platforms are necessary in order to build a house. Your job is to tell the contractor, I need, three rooms and this high and this, big and all of that. The rest is none of your business. It's their business to decide that, and if there's subcontractors, then it's up to them. But it's sort of you reaching over and starting to command everybody in the chain. This is micromanagement. How good is micromanagement? All right. So the way you would fix this is to only rely on things that derive from account. So perhaps account will need to have a way to give you a print balance. And then inside of that will be hidden the call to print format, but it will be inside of the bank account. Correct. Yeah. Another way of seeing, which is actually much more common. This is kind of difficult to notice here, but another way of noticing a violation of this law is when you see something called, let's say F is an object of a particular type, and then you call function G that returns an object of some other type, and then you call function H of that. It's the same thing. It's like F trying to call H, even though H is too many levels removed. So very often I would see in code, you know, dot something, dot something, dot something, because it's so much easier to write on the same line, but it's a violation. Because now everything is coupled along the line with a dot. And you can't change anything without propagating that change everywhere. All right, next one. Single responsibility principle or strong cohesion. That's another one. So weak coupling and strong cohesion, I'm sure you've heard it this at least several times in 143 and maybe elsewhere. Single responsibility means that each object, each class, object of class, should be responsible for one and only one thing. The minute it becomes responsible for two different things, the minute you rely on it for two different functionalities, now when you need to use it with only one of them, you are actually forced to use it with the other one as well, because it's just one object. I can't do one but not do the other. The God object metaphor here is an interesting story that I got from a seminar, and I'll tell you right now what it means. It's when you have an object that had one responsibility, but then over time, more and more additions were requested from the customer, and so you added a method here and a feature there and a method here and a feature there, and the class grew and grew and grew. And by the time you looked at it next time, you know, you look at the code and you say, "Oh my God, that's why it's a God object." But of course, the other way to interpret it is that, like God, it can do anything, because all the functionality is inside of there. You know, both of these things are actually not something you would want. So, single responsibility. Just keep them short, simple, crisp. That's the intent here. What's the violation in the example that I've given? Every class is doing more than one thing if you have more than one method. I mean, are they conceptually different or are they conceptually the same? I think that's the question you should be asking. So how many conceptually different things is this class trying to do? Two? Which two?
Well, I think it's trying to establish connections and break connections, and then it's also trying to transfer information.
Yeah. So those are two independent things. Remember the use case we had earlier, when you've got a login and then you've got a read mail. I mean, those are two different things. There's no reason for both of these to be part of the same entity. You know, there's a login entity and then there's a, you know, read, write, delete, whatever it is. So here you actually have to break this thing into two parts, because that's has the responsibility to establish a connection and the second team has the responsibility to transfer data or messages. You might imagine a situation where you need to do only one of these things and not both. But if that's your definition of an interface modem, then you somehow have to have both. And the more things you have, the harder it becomes to maintain, the more code you have to look at, even though all you need is this small, you know, method, perhaps. It's at least one reason why that's not a good idea. One other reason, beyond the ones we mentioned. The Model View Controller is actually a very good pattern. It's a design pattern. I'm sure some of you have, at least maybe most of you have seen instances of it in 143 when you were building sample applications. The point there is exactly this, that the model has its own responsibility to hold the state, do all the computation. The view is the thing that's responsible for outputting the information on the screen, but it doesn't store any state. It doesn't do any computation. The thinner you do the GUI, the less, the more you deprive it of any sort of state keeping on computation, the easier it is. And then the controller, in this case, will be the one that takes care of incoming events and handling those and maybe communicating with the model to decide what to send to the screen and whatnot. So that's a clean distinction between those three. You might imagine all of them being part of the same object. And that's probably going to be the first thing that somebody who's not familiar with the MVC pattern would do. But then if that's the case, it becomes all that much more difficult to test each of these individual components, and it becomes all that much more difficult to change one without changing all of them. All right. Yes? Oh, by all means. The question is whether you want these things part of the same thing. Of course, it needs to at some point dial and then hang up at the end. Now, the question of whether send and receive should be part of the same thing or fundamentally different is one of your design decisions. So, it really depends on whether there is a potential to only be needing to do a send in a particular situation, in a particular context, and never be needing to do a receive. Or vice versa, if only you need to do a receive, but never to do a send. Perhaps, you know, here's an example. If this was some low power device that could only, like an RFID, for instance, that could only be receiving, but it doesn't have a power source to be sending things. Perhaps in that context, it will only need a receive itself and not a send. In the case of a modem, where both of these are sort of happening, so you do need one and you do need the other, then it makes more sense for these two to be part of the same. But I'm not arguing that for whatever else you do here, that's the kind of distinction you need. So it's a question you need to be asking yourself. Are these things ever going to be needed, you know, only one of them and not the other?
So I guess what I wanted to say was, like, yeah, I can see how the principle is violated in that class. So it seems like a legitimate class design to me, too.
It's a close call. It's a close call. It's not...
Depending on the system.
Correct. Correct. Okay. All right. Next one. All right, now the things with the weird names. Open-close principle. How can that possibly be true? We both open and close. But that's exactly what the principle said. Software entities, clients, modules, functions, etc., should be open for extension, but closed for modification. And the reason why that is that it's so much easier to write new code than it is to modify or extend old code. Not only easier as a programmer, but it also means that if you are modifying old code, then some things change. Those changes may propagate elsewhere, and they may require further changes. Whereas, if all you're doing is adding a new module, maybe inheriting from an existing class into a subclass, and making only the change there, then all you're doing is really localized. So if there's a problem with it, you know where to look for it. Whereas if you do a modification, then it can propagate many, many places. So the example here, it was hard to fit one on the slide. So the example is really with words. It's extending an abstract class, because that's why we have abstract class, rather than modifying an existing class to accommodate each new addition. So you've got a class, perhaps initially it's a concrete one, it's not an abstract class, and there's always pressure to add this thing and add that thing and add this behavior and that new function. So think about breaking it up at this point into several classes and maybe creating an abstract class that only contains the cores of all of those. And then you would be subclassing this abstract class. And each new addition will now be localized to a subclass as opposed to, you know, within the same entity, growing like the dot object metaphor that I just mentioned before. So open for extension. You want to be able to extend the system, but as little as possible in terms of modification. If you find yourself having to modify over and over and over again and digging into the same modules, then maybe this principle is not supported. And it's up to you, as on the previous example with Bishop's comment, it's up to you to decide what to fix, you know, where to say these things are not going to change. These things are going to be like this. I'm assuming that my system is always going to be like that. Because it gets increasingly complex and increasingly expensive to make a system that's flexible on all kinds of directions. I mean, you have to make decisions. You have to decide that it's not going to be flexible in that direction at the expense of more flexibility in the other dimension. So there's no direct algorithm. This is just a principle. You know, find out what matters to you, how the system may evolve in the future. Make it flexible in those directions and not flexible in the others, because not flexibility means simplicity. So this kind of is contrary to the principle of simplicity, but also complementary. Okay. I think I will stop here. 10:40. There's more principles, and I will keep talking about them. The point is that I don't want to do it too quickly, because these are important, and we need to hear about them, and I'd like to be able to draw and ask as many questions as necessary. So, thank you.